process. So he started leaving more and longer comments, knowing it would help him critically examine his thinking. In effect, Bugham's prepares for the postmortem from the moment the tournament question is announced. Often, postmortems are as careful and self-critical as the thinking that goes into making the initial forecast. Commenting on a question about elections in Guinea, a question his team aced, Devon emphasized that they couldn't take all the credit. "I think that with Guinea, we were more inclined to believe that the protests wouldn't prevent the elections from taking place. But then they nearly did. So we lucked out, too." That was deeply perceptive. People often assume that when a decision is followed by a good outcome, the decision was good, which isn't always true, and can be dangerous if it blinds us to the flaws in our thinking. The successful are not usually so open to the idea that they didn't entirely earn their success. In my EPJ research in the late 1980s, I had the experts forecast whether the Communist Party would remain in power in the Soviet Union, whether there would be a violent overthrow of apartheid in South Africa, and whether Quebec would separate from Canada. After the deadlines for three forecasts passed, and the correct answers were clear, no, no, and no, I asked the experts to consider the plausibility of counterfactual scenarios, in which small butterfly effect tweaks caused history to unfold differently. When the what-ifery implied that their failed forecast would have turned out right, for example, if the coup against Gorbachev in 1991 had been better planned, and the plotters had been less drunk and better organized, the Communist Party would still be in power, the experts tended to welcome the what-if tale like an old friend. But when the scenarios implied that their correct forecast could easily have turned out wrong, they dismissed it as speculative. So experts were open to "I was almost right" scenarios, but rejected "I was almost wrong" alternatives. Not Devon. In triumph, he had no problem saying, "We lucked out." Grit. The analogy between forecasting and bicycling is pretty good, but, as with all analogies, the fit isn't perfect. With bike riding, the try, fail, analyze, adjust, and try again cycle typically takes seconds. With forecasting, it can take months or years. Plus, there is the bigger role of chance in forecasting. Cyclists who follow best cycling practices can usually expect excellent outcomes, but forecasters should be more tentative. Following best practices improves their odds of winning, but less reliably so than in games where chance plays smaller roles. Even with a growth mindset, the forecaster who wants to improve has to have a lot of what my colleague Angela Duckworth dubbed grit. Elizabeth Sloan has plenty of grit. Diagnosed with brain cancer, Elizabeth endured chemotherapy, a failed stem cell transplant, recurrence, and 2 more years of chemo. But she never relented. She volunteered for the Good Judgment Project to regrow her synapses. She also found an article by a top oncologist that described her situation perfectly, leading to a promising new stem cell transplant. "And here I am about to be cured," she emailed GJP project manager Terry Murray. "It is amazing that I have a second chance." Grit is a passionate perseverance of long-term goals, even in the face of frustration and failure. Married with a growth mindset, it is a potent force for personal progress. When Anne Kilkenny first heard of the GJP, she realized she would be an unusual volunteer. You want a housewife that hasn't been actively involved in anything geopolitical ever? 4 decades removed from having had a real intellectual challenge? She recalled thinking. I'll give it a go. Anne lives in a small town in Alaska. When she graduated from the University of California, Berkeley, in the hippie era, she wanted to be a high school teacher. So she applied to a teaching program, but wasn't accepted. She worked as an administrative assistant, a bookkeeper, and a substitute teacher, became a ballroom dancer, sang in choirs, married a carpenter from Alaska, raised a son, and went to church. She ends all her emails with her personal motto: live simply, love generously, care deeply, speak kindly, leave the rest to God. Anne had a brief brush with fame in 2008 when the Republican presidential candidate, John McCain, announced that his running mate would be the governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin. It was a startling choice. Few outside the state had ever heard of the former mayor of the small town of Wasilla. But Anne Kilkenny had. Wasilla is our hometown, and Anne is one of those rare, public-spirited citizens who attend town council meetings. So she wrote an email summarizing what Palin had done as mayor and sent it to family and friends outside the state. They wanted to know more, so she added more detail and sent it out again. It went viral. Soon Anne had a reporter from the New York Times calling her, then Newsweek, the Associated Press, the Boston Globe, the St. Petersburg Times, and so many more. It was a frenzy. Anne is a Democrat, and her email was largely critical of Palin. So much of the torrent of emails sent to her was highly partisan. "I knew it," someone would write. "I knew Palin was totally ignorant of geopolitics as soon as I saw her face." And there were bucket loads of praise for Anne. She was courageous, brilliant, fantastic in every way. But Anne kept her head. Rather than revel in the adulation, she arched a skeptical eyebrow. "How could anybody know these things from a glimpse of the person?" she wrote me. They couldn't, and they didn't. They had made their mind up about Palin from the outset because of her partisan affiliation, because she was a woman, etc., and learning facts about her just gave them excuses for their prejudices. Feelings were masquerading as knowledge, as thoughts. That sort of critical, psychologically astute observation helps make a forecaster a super forecaster. So does careful, accurate research. And Anne's famous email held up well when it was scrutinized by national fact-checking organizations, which is particularly impressive considering that Anne thought she was merely drafting a short note for friends and family. Anne's tenacity is daunting. When the tournament asked a question about refugee numbers in the Central African Republic, she went to the UN's website and saw the data were a week old. Rather than assume those were the most recent numbers available, she emailed the agency and asked how often the data were updated and when the next update could be expected. She also noticed their data showed large fluctuations. Again, she queried the agency. She got a response, but it was in French. "Merci," she wrote back. "Mais je ne parle pas français plus bien. S'il vous plaît en anglais?" Back came a lengthy response in English, explaining the agency's analytical methods, which was very revealing and a great help in making a forecast. Anne isn't a super forecaster, at least not yet, but her results are still impressive. She forecast all 150 questions in year 3, and she had a pretty inert team, which meant she had to do almost all of the work herself. Why did she do it? For the same reason a college student might take all the toughest courses with the hardest grading professors. She cared more about learning than getting top grades. "I am always trying to grow, to learn, to change," she wrote me. We could see that attitude in her behavior as results started coming in. She thought carefully about them and what they suggested about how she makes decisions, and often shared thoughtful, introspective emails with our project manager. She kept this up while her Breyer score improved, and it looked like she might crack the top ranks. And she kept at it when some of her high-confidence forecasts ended badly and her accuracy plunged. Question after question, month after month, she kept at it. That's grit. It's also why I wouldn't be at all surprised to see her ultimately become a super forecaster. Of course, that would not be the end of Anne's growth. As the super forecasters have shown, only the end of the beginning. There is always more trying, more failing, more analyzing, more adjusting, and trying again. Computer programmers have a wonderful term for a program that is not intended to be released in a final version, but will instead be used, analyzed, and improved without end. It is perpetual beta. Super forecasters are perpetual beta. Pulling it all together. We have learned a lot about super forecasters, from their lives to their test scores to their work habits. Taking stock, we can now sketch a rough composite portrait of a modal super forecaster. In philosophic outlook, they tend to be cautious, nothing is certain, humble, reality is infinitely complex, non-deterministic, what happens is not meant to be and does not have to happen. In their abilities and thinking styles, they tend to be actively open-minded. Beliefs are hypotheses to be tested, not treasures to be protected. Intelligent and knowledgeable with a need for cognition. Intellectually curious, enjoy puzzles and mental challenges. Reflective, introspective and self-critical. Numerate, comfortable with numbers. In their methods of forecasting, they tend to be pragmatic, not wedded to any idea or agenda. Analytical, capable of stepping back from the tip of your nose perspective and considering other views. Dragonfly-eyed, value diverse views and synthesize them into their own. Probabilistic, judge using many grades of maybe. Thoughtful updaters, when facts change, they change their minds. Good intuitive psychologists, aware of the value of checking thinking for cognitive and emotional biases. In their work ethic, they tend to have a growth mindset, believe it's possible to get better. Grit, determined to keep at it however long it takes. I paint with a broad brush here. Not every attribute is equally important. The strongest predictor of rising into the ranks of super forecasters is perpetual beta, the degree to which one is committed to belief updating and self-improvement. It is roughly 3 times as powerful a predictor as its closest rival, intelligence. To paraphrase Thomas Edison, super forecasting appears to be roughly 75% perspiration, 25% inspiration. And not every super forecaster has every attribute. There are many paths to success and many ways to compensate for a deficit in one area with strength in another. The predictive power of perpetual beta does suggest, though, that no matter how high one's IQ, it is difficult to compensate for lack of dedication to the personal project of growing one's synapses. All that said, there is another element that is missing entirely from the sketch: other people. In our private lives and our workplaces, we seldom make judgments about the future entirely in isolation. We are a social species. We decide together. This raises an important question. What happens when super forecasters work in groups? Chapter 9. Super Teams. On the morning of January 10, 1961, as breakfast was being prepared across America, readers of the New York Times opened the newspaper on the kitchen table and read the front page headline: U.S. helps train an anti-Castro force at secret Guatemalan air ground base. A little inland from Guatemala's Pacific coast, commando-like forces are being drilled in guerrilla warfare tactics by foreign personnel, mostly from the United States. The trainees were identified as Cubans. American aircraft using the base were identified. The American company that built the base was named. Guatemalan authorities, from President Miguel Ydígoras Fuentes down, insist that the military effort is designed to meet an assault, expected almost any day from Cuba, the Times reported. But opponents of the Ydígoras administration have insisted that the preparations are for an offensive against the regime of Premier Fidel Castro, and that they are being planned and directed, and to a great extent paid for, by the United States. The United States Embassy is maintaining complete silence on the subject. In truth, the CIA was training Cuban exiles to land in Cuba and launch a guerrilla war against the new government of Fidel Castro. Secrecy was critical. Once the guerrillas landed, they had to look like an independent force of patriots coming to liberate the nation. To ensure this, no American soldiers would land with the guerrillas, and air support would be provided by old bombers without American markings. No one would know that the United States engineered the whole thing. At least, that was the plan. One might suppose that in Washington, D.C., among the planners of this secret mission, the exposure of the scheme on the front page of the New York Times would cause concern and reconsideration. There was indeed concern, but no reconsideration. Somehow the idea took hold around the cabinet table that this would not matter much so long as United States soldiers did not take part in the actual fighting, Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. recalled. As an advisor to the new president, John F. Kennedy, Schlesinger was part of the inner circle that authorized the mission, and his recollections were filled with amazement at the blunders they made in planning what became known as the Bay of Pigs invasion. When the CIA-trained guerrillas landed, the Cuban army was waiting, and the 1,400 men on shore were quickly surrounded by 20,000 soldiers. Within 3 days, they were all dead or taken prisoner. The problem was not one of execution. It was the plan. It was harebrained. And that's not hindsight bias. The whole Sari saga has been dissected, and there is rare consensus among historians, left and right, that the plan was riddled with problems that the White House should have spotted, but did not. A particularly blatant example was the contingency plan. The CIA assured the president's advisors that if the landing failed, the guerrillas could escape to the Escambray Mountains, where they would join other anti-Castro forces. But that idea came from the first version of the plan, which would have landed the guerrillas on the shore of the base of the mountains. The planners had switched the landing site, but didn't consider what that switch meant for the contingency plan. I don't think we fully realize that the Escambray Mountains lay 80 miles from the Bay of Pigs, across a hopeless tangle of swamps and jungle, Schlesinger recalled. After the debacle, no one believed that the United States was not involved, and the consequences were immediate and severe. Traditional allies were embarrassed. Latin American nations were outraged. Anti-American protests erupted around the world. Liberals who had high hopes for the new Kennedy administration felt betrayed, while conservatives mocked the novice president's incompetence. Worst of all, for the strategic interests of the United States, the Cuban government put itself more firmly inside the Soviet camp. Within 18 months, an island off the coast of Florida was a base for 5,000 Soviet soldiers and an array of Soviet intermediate-range nuclear missiles that could destroy Washington, D.C. and New York City, and the two global superpowers were locked in a crisis that Kennedy estimated, in retrospect, had between a one-third and one-half chance of escalating into nuclear war. The story of the Cuban Missile Crisis that followed from the Bay of Pigs fiasco is equally familiar, but the similarities end there. Over 13 terrifying days in October 1962, the Kennedy administration considered a range of dangerous options to counter the Soviet threat, including outright invasion, before settling on a naval blockade. As Soviet ships approached the American Red Line, each side tried to figure out the other's intentions from its actions and back-channel communications. Finally, an agreement was reached, war was averted, and the world exhaled. If the Bay of Pigs was the Kennedy administration's nadir, the Cuban Missile Crisis was its zenith, a moment when Kennedy and his team creatively engineered a positive result under extreme pressure. Knowing this, we might assume Kennedy cleaned house after the Bay of Pigs and surrounded himself with far superior advisors in time for the missile crisis. But he didn't. The cast of characters in both dramas is mostly the same. The team that bungled the Bay of Pigs was the team that performed brilliantly during the Cuban Missile Crisis. In his 1972 classic, Victims of Groupthink, the psychologist Irving Janis, one of my PhD advisors at Yale long ago, explored the decision-making that went into both the Bay of Pigs invasion and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Today, everyone has heard of groupthink, although few have read the book that coined the term, or know that Janis meant something more precise than the vague catchphrase groupthink has become today. In Janis's hypothesis, members of any small cohesive group tend to maintain esprit de corps by unconsciously developing a number of shared illusions and related norms that interfere with critical thinking and reality testing. Groups that get along too well don't question assumptions or confront uncomfortable facts. So everyone agrees, which is pleasant, and the fact that everyone agrees is tacitly taken to be proof the group is on the right track. We can't all be wrong, can we? So if a secret American plan to invade Cuba without apparent American involvement happens to be published on the front page of the New York Times, the plan can still go ahead. Just make sure there are no American soldiers on the beach and deny American involvement. The world will believe it. And if that sounds implausible, well, not to worry. No one in the group has objected, which means everyone thinks it's perfectly reasonable, so it must be. After the fiasco, Kennedy ordered an inquiry to figure out how his people could have botched it so badly. It identified cozy unanimity as the key problem and recommended changes to the decision-making process to ensure it could never develop again. Skepticism was the new watchword. Participants were to speak not only as specialists in their area of expertise, but as generalists, with a license to question anything. Special counsel Theodore Sorensen and the president's brother Bobby were designated intellectual watchdogs, whose job was to pursue relentlessly every bone of contention in order to prevent errors arising from too superficial an analysis of the issues, Janice noted. Accepting this role avidly, Robert Kennedy, at the expense of becoming unpopular with some of his associates, barked out sharp and sometimes rude questions. Often he deliberately became the devil's advocate. Protocol and hierarchy would impede these freewheeling discussions, so they were set aside. New advisors were occasionally brought in to provide fresh perspectives. And John F. Kennedy would sometimes leave the room to let the group talk things through, knowing that there was less true give and take when the president was present. That last consideration was crucial. Kennedy started the crisis thinking that, at a minimum, he had to authorize preemptive airstrikes on the Soviet missile launchers. But he kept that to himself, so it wouldn't be the focus of the discussion. As a result, by the end of the first day of meetings, the committee had seriously discussed 10 alternatives, and the president's thinking started to change. It was never easy. There were constant disagreements. The stress was brutal. But it was a process that led to a negotiated peace, not nuclear war. How the Kennedy White House changed its decision-making culture for the better is a must-read for students of management and public policy, because it captures the dual-edge nature of working in groups. Teams can cause terrible mistakes. They can also sharpen judgment and accomplish together what cannot be done alone. Managers tend to focus on the negative or the positive, but they need to see both. As mentioned earlier, the term wisdom of crowds comes from James Surowiecki's 2004 bestseller of the same name. But Surowiecki's title was itself a play on the title of a classic 1841 book, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, which chronicle the litany of collective folly. Groups can be wise or mad or both. What makes the difference isn't just who is in the group, Kennedy's circle of advisors demonstrated. The group is its own animal. To team or not to team. In the IARPA tournament, our goal was accuracy. Would putting forecasters on teams help? We saw strong arguments for both yes and no. On the negative side, the research literature, as well as my decades of experience on university committees, suggested that teams might foster cognitive loafing. Why labor to master a complex problem when others will do the heavy lifting? When this attitude is widespread, it can sink a team. Worse, forecasters can become too friendly, letting groupthink set in. These two tendencies can reinforce each other. We all agree, so our work is done, right? And unanimity within a group is a powerful force. If that agreement is ill-founded, the group slips into self-righteous complacency. But groups also let people share information and perspectives. That's good. It helps make Dragonfly Eye work. And aggregation is critical to accuracy. Of course, aggregation can only do its magic when people form judgments independently, like the fairgoers guessing the weight of the ox. The independence of judgments ensures that errors are more or less random, so they cancel each other out. When people gather and discuss in a group, independence of thought and expression can be lost. Maybe one person is a loudmouth who dominates the discussion, or a bully, or a superficially impressive talker, or someone with credentials that cow others into line. In so many ways, a group can get people to abandon independent judgment and buy into errors. When that happens, the mistakes will pile up, not cancel out. This is the root of collective folly, whether it's Dutch investors in the 17th century, who became collectively convinced that a tulip bulb was worth more than a laborer's annual salary, or American homebuyers in 2005, talking themselves into believing that real estate prices could only go up. But loss of independence isn't inevitable in a group, as JFK's team showed during the Cuban Missile Crisis. If forecasters can keep questioning themselves and their teammates and welcome vigorous debate, the group can become more than the sum of its parts. So would groups lift forecasters up or drag them down? Some of us suspected one outcome, others the opposite. But deep down, we knew we were all guessing. Ultimately, we chose to build teams into our research for two reasons. First, in the real world, people seldom make important forecasts without discussing them with others. So getting a better understanding of forecasting in the real world required a better understanding of forecasting in groups. The other reason? Curiosity. We didn't know the answer, and we wanted to. So we took Archie Cochran's advice and ran an experiment. In year one, 2011 to 12, before a single super forecaster had been tagged and classified, we randomly assigned several hundred forecasters to work alone, and several hundred others to work together in teams. The team forecasters wouldn't meet face-to-face, of course, but we created online forums for discussion, and team members could communicate by email, Skype, or however else they wanted. They would still be scored as individuals, but individual scores would be pooled to create a team score. Forecasters would see how both they and their team were doing. Beyond that, forecasters could organize however they wished. The goal was accuracy. How they achieved it was up to them. We also gave teams a primer on teamwork based on insights gleaned from research and group dynamics. On the one hand, we warned, groupthink is a danger. Be cooperative, but not deferential. Consensus is not always good. Disagreement, not always bad. If you do happen to agree, don't take that agreement, in itself, as proof that you are right. Never stop doubting. Pointed questions are as essential to a team as vitamins are to a human body. On the other hand, the opposite of groupthink, rancor and dysfunction, is also a danger. Team members must disagree without being disagreeable, we advised. Practice constructive confrontation, to use the phrase of Andy Grove, the former CEO of Intel. Precision questioning is one way to do that. Drawing on the work of Dennis Mathis and Monica Werlin, we showed them how to tactfully dissect the vague claims people often make. Suppose someone says, "Unfortunately, the popularity of soccer, the world's favorite pastime, is starting to decline." You suspect he is wrong. How do you question the claim? Don't even think of taking a personal shot like, "You're silly." That only adds heat, not light. "I don't think so" only expresses disagreement without delving into why you disagree. "What do you mean?" lowers the emotional temperature with a question, but it's much too vague. Zero in. You might say, "What do you mean by pastime?" or "What evidence is there that soccer's popularity is declining? Over what time frame?" The answers to these precise questions won't settle the matter, but they will reveal the thinking behind the conclusion, so it can be probed and tested. Since Socrates, good teachers have practiced precision questioning, but still it's often not used when it's needed most. Imagine how events might have gone if the Kennedy team had engaged in precision questioning when planning the Bay of Pigs invasion. "So what happens if they're attacked and the plan falls apart?" "They retreat into the Escambray Mountains, where they can meet up with other anti-Castro forces and plan guerrilla operations." "How far is it from the proposed landing site in the Bay of Pigs to the Escambray Mountains?"
80 miles.
"And what's the terrain?"
"Mostly swamp and jungle."
"So the guerrillas have been attacked. The plan falls apart. They don't have helicopters or tanks. But they have to cross 80 miles of swamp and jungle before they can begin to look for shelter in the mountains? Is that correct?" I suspect that this conversation would not have concluded, "Sounds good." Questioning like that didn't happen. So Kennedy's first major decision as president was a fiasco. The lesson was learned, resulting in the robust but respectful debates of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which exemplified the spirit we encouraged among our forecasters. Super teams. At the end of the year, the results were unequivocal. On average, teams were 23% more accurate than individuals. When year two arrived, We all agreed teams should be an essential part of the research design. But we faced another choice. Having identified the top forecasters across experimental conditions, what should we do with these freshly anointed super forecasters? Should they be told of their status? Should they be put together in teams and hope that super forecasters working with each other would produce super teams? The risks were obvious. Tell someone they're exceptionally good at something and they may start taking their superiority for granted. Surround them with others who are similarly accomplished, tell them how special they are, and egos may swell even more. Rather than spur a super forecaster to take his game to the next level, it might make him so sure of himself that he is tempted to think his judgment must be right because it is his judgment. This is a familiar paradox. Success can lead to a claim that can undermine the habits of mind that produce the success. Such hubris often afflicts highly accomplished individuals. In business circles, it is called CEO disease. Again, we rolled the theoretical dice. We created teams of super forecasters with a dozen people on each. We gave them more guidance about how high-performance teams function and created special forums to help them communicate online. The teams did not meet face-to-face, which had its own pluses and minuses. On the minus side, it's easier to disregard people we have never met. It could even foster conflict. Look at how quickly discussion on the internet can degenerate into poisonous harangues. On the plus side, distance could make it easier to manage disputes and maintain a critical perspective. Joining a team for the first time, super forecasters like Elaine Rich had more immediate concerns. "I was pretty intimidated by my team," she told me. Elaine lives in Washington, D.C., and works as a pharmacist at the Walter Reed Medical Center. Some of the people on her team announced huge, impressive credentials, she recalled, "and I had no credentials." At first, she stayed quiet, making forecasts but rarely venturing opinions. It wasn't only that her teammates had credentials and confidence. She found it difficult to question the views of teammates who were, after all, strangers. People take things differently. What one person would consider a helpful inquiry, another might take as an aggressive criticism. And some of the questions touched on issues many people feel passionately about. So talking about them felt like walking through a minefield. The Arafat polonium discussion was the worst. "There was a lot of tension around that," Elaine said. "It was almost a taboo question." "There was a lot of what I'll call dancing around," recalled Marty Rosenthal of his first year on the team. People would disagree with someone's assessment and want to test it, but they were too afraid of giving offense to just come out and say what they were thinking. So they would couch it in all these careful words, circling around, hoping the point would be made without their having to make it. Experience helped. Seeing this dancing around, people realized that excessive politeness was hindering the critical examination of views, so they made special efforts to assure others that criticism was welcome. "Everybody said, 'I want pushback from you if you see something I don't,'" said Rosenthal. That made a difference. So did offering thanks for constructive criticism. Gradually, the dancing around diminished. Research on teams often assumes they have leaders and norms and focuses on ensuring these don't hinder performance. The usual solutions are those the Kennedy administration implemented after the Bay of Pigs invasion: bringing in outsiders, suspend hierarchy, and keep the leader's views under wraps. There's also the pre-mortem, in which the team is told to assume a course of action has failed and to explain why, which makes team members feel safe to express doubts they have about the leader's plan. But the super teams did not start with leaders and norms, which created other challenges. Marty Rosenthal is semi-retired now, but for decades he was a management consultant who specialized in building teams. Doing that with no organizational structure is a challenge, he knew, and doing that without meeting face-to-face is tougher still. Someone could step forward and start giving directions, but among strangers that can backfire. "I saw the gaps in how we were forming up as a team, wanted to address some of that, but also didn't want to be seen as, you know, taking over," he said. "And so a lot of what I did was what I think of as leading from behind. I just tried to lead by example." When Marty felt people weren't explaining their forecasts enough to get good discussions going, he explained his in greater detail and invited comments. He also organized a conference call to hash out workloads, with details handled by him, and most of the team signed up. The feedback afterward was people loved it, Marty said. I think people felt a little stronger commitment to the team coming out of that. There were also two opportunities for super forecasters to meet teammates face-to-face, at the end of the second and third years, when GJP project manager Terry Murray hosted conferences at the Wharton School and the University of California, Berkeley. The official goal of the gatherings was to share knowledge. The researchers presented data, and the super forecasters offered their views. The unofficial goal was to add a human dimension to the teams. Many super forecasters made the most of it. Marty lives less than a mile from the Berkeley campus, so he invited his teammates, most came to the conference, to his house for a barbecue and beer. Modest as this and his other efforts were, Marty thinks they made a difference. Definitely it's helped our ability to push back on each other and feel a commitment that we really need to step up and share information when we have it. That sense of belonging developed in Elaine Rich. She did well, boosting her confidence, and her sense of responsibility grew with it. I felt that I had to be really careful that I was sharing, shouldering my part of the burden, rather than being a freeloader by reading what other people wrote, and not offering thoughts and research, which is always a temptation. Most teams have a nucleus of 5 or 6 members who do most of the work. Within that core, we might expect to see a division of labor that reduces the amount of effort any one person needs to invest in the task, at least if he or she approached forecasting as work, not play. But we saw the opposite on the best teams. Workloads were divided, but as commitment grew, so did the amount of effort forecasters put into it. Being on the team was tons more work, Elaine said, but she didn't mind. She found it far more stimulating than working by herself. You could be supporting each other or helping each other or building on ideas, she said. It was a rush. Committed super teams did some impressive digging. On a question about who would win the 2013 presidential election in Honduras, Paul Theron, a South African super forecaster, and an investment manager who hosts Hot Stocks on CNBC Africa, located a political scientist who specializes in Honduran politics and was told, among other tidbits, that although polls showed a candidate named Castro with a slight lead, the polls were dodgy. Theron also found an analysis of Honduran politics on an obscure website and was so impressed by its thoroughness and the author's credentials that he emailed him and had an informative discussion. Paul changed his forecast, giving Castro's opponent, Hernandez, the edge. Hernandez won, and Paul's considerable effort paid off. And since Paul shared everything he learned with his teammates, they benefited too. The team is so much more effective at gathering information than one person could ever be, Paul told me. There is simply no way that any individual could cover as much ground as a good team does. Even if you had unlimited hours, it would be less fruitful, given different research styles. Each team member brings something different. The results speak for themselves. On average, when a forecaster did well enough in year one to become a super forecaster and was put on a super forecaster team in year two, that person became 50% more accurate. An analysis in year three got the same result. Given that these were collections of strangers tenuously connected in cyberspace, we found that result startling. Even more surprising was how well super teams did against prediction markets. Most economists would say markets are the most effective mechanism for collecting widely dispersed information and distilling it down to a single judgment. Markets do that with trading. If I think a stock is a good value at a certain price, I may offer to buy yours. If you agree with my judgment, you won't sell. If you think I'm wrong, you will. Of course, in reality, trades happen for other reasons. You and I may have different financial needs steering us in different directions. But in general, markets create incentives for people to relentlessly second-guess each other. The aggregation of all those judgments and the information they are based on is expressed in the price. If many people agree with me that a stock is worth more than it's selling for, they will try to buy it. Increasing demand pushes the price up. In that way, all the individual judgments of the buyers and all the information guiding those judgments becomes priced in. None of this means markets are perfect or such efficient aggregators of information that no mortal should ever be so foolish as to aspire to beat them. That's the strong version of what economists call the efficient market hypothesis. And it's hard to square with what we've learned from psychology and experience. Markets make mistakes. Sometimes they lose their collective minds. But even if markets are far less efficient than ardent proponents of the EMH suppose, it is still very hard to consistently beat markets, which is why so few can plausibly claim to have done it. Prediction markets are simply markets that trade in predictions, meaning traders buy and sell contracts on specified outcomes, such as Hillary Clinton will be elected president of the United States in 2016. When the election of 2016 is held, that contract is settled. If Clinton loses, the contract pays out nothing. If she wins, it pays out a dollar. If the contract is currently selling for 40 cents, and I think Clinton has a 60% or 70% chance of winning, I should buy. If lots of traders agree with me, demand for the contract will be strong and the price will rise, until it reaches a level where more traders think it's about right and buying slackens. If a new event suggests Clinton will not win, there will be a rush to sell and the price will decline. By aggregating all these judgments, the contract price should, in theory, closely track the true probability of Hillary Clinton winning. Prediction markets like the famous Iowa electronic markets have an impressive track record, and they have a theory backed by a battalion of Nobel laureates going for them. So who would win in a battle between super teams and prediction markets? Most economists would say it's no contest. Prediction markets would mop the floor with the super teams. We put that proposition to the test by randomly assigning regular forecasters to one of three experimental conditions. Some worked alone, others worked in teams, and some were traders in prediction markets run by companies such as Inkling and Luminogic. Of course, after year one, when the value of teams was resoundingly demonstrated, nobody expected forecasters working alone to compete at the level of teams or prediction markets, so we combined all their forecasts and calculated the unweighted average to get the wisdom of the crowd. And of course, we had one more competitor, super teams. The results were clear-cut each year. Teams of ordinary forecasters beat the wisdom of the crowd by about 10%. Prediction markets beat ordinary teams by about 20%. And super teams beat prediction markets by 15% to 30%. I can already hear the protests from my colleagues in finance that the only reason the super teams beat the prediction markets was that our markets lacked liquidity. Real money wasn't at stake, and we didn't have a critical mass of traders. They may be right. It is a testable idea and one worth testing. It's also important to recognize that while super teams beat prediction markets did a pretty good job of forecasting complex global events. How did super teams do so well? By avoiding the extremes of groupthink and internet flame wars. And by fostering mini-cultures, they encouraged people to challenge each other respectfully, admit ignorance, and request help. In key ways, super teams resembled the best surgical teams identified by Harvard's Amy Edmondson, in which the nurse doesn't hesitate to tell the surgeon he left a sponge behind the pancreas because she knows it is psychologically safe to correct higher ops. Edmondson's best teams had a shared purpose. So did our super teams. One sign of that was linguistic. They said our more than my. A team like that should promote the sort of actively open-minded thinking that is so critical to accurate forecasting, as we saw in Chapter 5. So just as we surveyed individuals to test their active open-mindedness, AOM, we surveyed teams to probe their attitudes toward the group and patterns of interaction within the group. That is, we tested the team's AOM. As expected, we found a correlation between a team's AOM and its accuracy. Little surprise there. But what makes a team more or less actively open-minded? You might think it's the individuals on the team. Put high AOM people in a team, and you'll get a high AOM team. Put lower AOM people in a team,
and you'll get a lower AOM team.
Not so, as it turns out. Teams were not merely the sum of their parts. How the group thinks collectively is an emergent property of the group itself, a property of communication patterns among group members, not just the thought processes inside each member. A group of open-minded people who don't care about one another will be less than the sum of its open-minded parts. A group of opinionated people who engage one another in pursuit of the truth will be more than the sum of its opinionated parts. All this brings us to the final feature of winning teams, the fostering of a culture of sharing. My Warden colleague Adam Grant categorizes people as givers, matchers, and takers. Givers are those who contribute more to others than they receive in return. Matchers give as much as they get. Takers give less than they take. Cynics might say that giver is a polite word for chump. After all, anyone inclined to freeload will happily take what they can give and return nothing, leaving the giver worse off than if he weren't so generous. But Grant's research shows that the pro-social example of the giver can improve the behavior of others, which helps everyone, including the giver, which explains why Grant has found that givers tend to come out on top. Marty Rosenthal is a giver. He wasn't indiscriminately generous with his time and effort. He was generous in a deliberate effort to change the behavior of others for the benefit of all. Although Marty didn't know Grant's work, when I described it to him, he said, "You got it." There are lots more givers on the super teams. Doug Lorch distributed programming tools, which got others thinking about creating and sharing their own. Tim Minto contributed an analysis that showed how to make valuable automatic tweaks to forecasts with the passage of time. All are givers. None is a chump. In fact, Doug Lorch's individual score was the best in year two, while Tim Minto topped the chart in year three. And each man's team won the team competition. But let's not take this too far. A busy executive might think, "I want some of those," and imagine the recipe is straightforward. Shop for top performers, marinate them in collaborative teams, strain out the groupthink, sprinkle in some givers, and wait for the smart decisions and money to start flowing. Sadly, it isn't that simple. Replicating this in an existing organization with real employees would be a challenge. Singling out people for a super status may be divisive, and transferring people into cross-functional teams can be disruptive. And there's no guarantee of results. There were eccentric exceptions to the tendencies outlined above, such as the few teams who were not mutually supportive, but who nonetheless did well. One of the best super forecasters even refused to leave comments for his teammates, saying he didn't want to risk groupthink. This is the messy world of psychological research. Solid conclusions take time, and this work, particularly on super teams, is in its infancy. There are many questions we have only begun to explore. One involves the provocative phrase, "diversity trumps ability," coined by my colleague and former competitor in the IARPA tournament, Scott Page. As we have seen, the aggregation of different perspectives is a potent way to improve judgment. But the key word is different. Combining uniform perspectives only produces more of the same, while slight variation will produce slight improvement. It is the diversity of the perspectives that makes the magic work. Super teams were fairly diverse, because super forecasters are fairly diverse, but we didn't design them with that in mind. We put ability first. If Page is right, we might have gotten even better results if we had made diversity the key determinant of team membership and let ability take care of itself. Again, though, flag the false dichotomy. The choice is not ability or diversity. It is fine-tuning the mixes of ability and diversity and gauging which work best in which situations. To appreciate this balancing act and how promising it is, think back to President Obama asking each member of his team of advisors how likely it was that the unusually tall man in the mystery house in Pakistan was Osama bin Laden. The answers ranged from 30% to 95%, most well over 50%. Add them up and divide by the number of advisors and, from the sketchy reports available, it averages out to roughly 70%. That's the wisdom of the crowd. It's a hard-to-beat number that should have been given more respect than it got in that meeting.
But could President Obama have done even better than that? Our research suggests yes, depending on the diversity of his team. The more diverse his team, the greater the chance that some advisors will possess scraps of information that others don't. And since these scraps mostly point toward "it's bin Laden," if all the advisors were given all the scraps they don't have, they would individually raise their estimate. And that would boost the wisdom of the crowd figure, maybe to 80% or 85%. That's the thinking behind the extremizing algorithm I mentioned in Chapter 4. It works superbly, but its effectiveness depends on diversity. A team with zero diversity, its members are clones, and everyone knows everything that everyone else knows, should not be extremized at all. Of course, no team matches that description. But some teams are good at sharing information, and that reduces diversity somewhat. Super forecaster teams were like that, which is why extremizing didn't help them much. But regular forecasting teams weren't as good at sharing information. As a result, we got major gains when we extremized them. Indeed, extremizing gave regular forecaster teams a big enough boost to pass some super teams, and extremizing a large pool of regular forecasters produced, as we saw earlier, tournament-winning results. These tools won't replace intelligence analysts or the officials who synthesize their conclusions, and they shouldn't. As far as I can see, there will always be a need for a chief executive to be surrounded by a smart team of advisors, as John F. Kennedy was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. But the tools are good enough that the remarkably inexpensive forecasts they generate should be on the desks of decision-makers, including the President of the United States. Chapter 10. The Leader's Dilemma. Leaders must decide, and to do that they must make and use forecasts. The more accurate those forecasts are, the better. So the lessons of super-forecasting should be of intense interest to them. But leaders must also act and achieve their goals. In a word, they must lead. And anyone who has led people may have doubts about how useful the lessons of super-forecasting really are for leaders. Ask people to list the qualities an effective leader must have, or consult the cottage industry devoted to leadership coaching, or examine rigorous research on the subject, and you will find near universal agreement on three basic points. Confidence will be on everyone's list. Leaders must be reasonably confident and instill confidence in those they lead, because nothing can be accomplished without the belief that it can be. Decisiveness is another essential attribute. Leaders can't ruminate endlessly. They need to size up the situation, make a decision, and move on. And leaders must deliver a vision, the goal that everyone strives together to achieve. But look at the style of thinking that produces super forecasting, and consider how it squares with what leaders must deliver. How can leaders be confident and inspire confidence if they see nothing as certain? How can they be decisive and avoid analysis paralysis if their thinking is so slow, complex, and self-critical? How can they act with relentless determination if they readily adjust their thinking in light of new information, or even conclude they were wrong? And underlying super forecasting is a spirit of humility, a sense that the complexity of reality is staggering, our ability to comprehend limited, and mistakes inevitable. No one ever described Winston Churchill, Steve Jobs, or any other great leader as humble. Well, maybe Gandhi, but try to name a second and a third. And consider how the super teams operated. They were given guidance on how to form an effective team, but nothing was imposed. No hierarchy, no direction, no formal leadership. These little anarchist cells may work as forums for the endless consideration and reconsideration super forecasters like to engage in, but they're hardly organizations that can pull together and get things done. That takes structure, and a leader in charge. This looks like a serious dilemma. Leaders must be forecasters and leaders, but it seems that what is required to succeed at one role may undermine the other. Fortunately, the contradiction between being a super forecaster and a super leader is more apparent than real. In fact, the super forecaster model can help make good leaders superb, and the organizations they lead smart, adaptable, and effective. The key is an approach to leadership and organization first articulated by 19th century Prussian general, perfected by the German army of World War II, made foundational doctrine by the modern American military, and deployed by many successful corporations today. You might even find it at your neighborhood Walmart. Moltke's legacy. In war, everything is uncertain, wrote Helmut von Moltke. In the late 19th century, Moltke was famous the world over after he led Prussian forces to victory against Denmark in 1864, Austria in 1866, and France in 1871. Victories that culminated in the unification of Germany. His writings on war, which were themselves influenced by the great theorist Karl von Clausewitz, profoundly shaped the German military that fought the two world wars. But Moltke was no Napoleon. He never saw himself as a visionary leader directing his army like chess pieces. His approach to leadership and organization was entirely different. The Prussian military had long appreciated uncertainty. They had invented board games with dice to introduce the element of chance missing from games like chess. But everything is uncertain was for Moltke an axiom whose implications needed to be teased out. The most urgent is to never entirely trust your plan. No plan of operations extends with certainty beyond the first encounter with the enemy's main strength, he wrote. That statement was refined and repeated over the decades, and today soldiers know it as, no plan survives contact with the enemy. That's much snappier. But notice that Moltke's original was more nuanced, which is typical of his thinking. It is impossible to lay down binding rules that apply in all circumstances, he wrote. In war, two cases never will be exactly the same. Improvisation is essential. Moltke trusted that his officers were up to the task. In addition to their military training, they received what we today would consider a liberal arts education, with an emphasis on critical thinking. Even when the curriculum focused on purely military matters, students were expected to think hard. In other nations of that era, including the United States, instructors laid out problems, told students the right answer, and expected them to nod and memorize. In Germany's war academies, scenarios were laid out and students were invited to suggest solutions and discuss them collectively. Disagreement was not only permitted, it was expected, and even the instructor's views could be challenged because he understood himself to be a comrade among others, noted the historian Jörg Muth. Even the views of generals were subject to scrutiny. German junior officers were regularly asked for their opinions, and they would criticize the outcome of a large maneuver with several divisions before the attending general had the floor. The acceptance of criticism went beyond the classroom, and under extraordinary circumstances, more than criticism was tolerated. In 1758, when Prussia's King Frederick the Great battled Russian forces at Zorndorf, he sent a messenger to the youngest Prussian general, Friedrich Wilhelm von Seydlich, who commanded a cavalry unit. Attack, the messenger said. Seydlich refused. He felt the time wasn't right and his forces would be wasted. The messenger left but later returned. He told Seydlich the king wanted him to attack. Again, Seydlich refused. A third time the messenger returned, and he warned Seydlich that if he didn't attack immediately, the king would have his head. Tell the king that after the battle my head is at his disposal, Seydlich responded. But meanwhile I will make use of it. Finally, when Seydlich judged the time right, he attacked and turned the battle in Prussia's favor. Friedrich the Great congratulated his general and let him keep his head. This story and others like it, notes Muth, were collective cultural knowledge within the Prussian officer corps, recounted and told countless times in an abundance of variations during official lectures, and the officers' mess were in the correspondence between comrades. The fundamental message, think. If necessary, discuss your orders, even criticize them. And if you absolutely must, and you better have a good reason, disobey them. All this may sound like a recipe for a fractious organization that can't get anything done, but that danger was avoided by balancing those elements that promoted independent thinking against those that demanded action. The time devoted to a decision was constrained by circumstances, so decision-making could be leisurely and complex or, when bullets were flying, abrupt and simple. If this meant a decision wasn't as informed as it could be, that was fine. An imperfect decision made in time was better than a perfect one made too late. Clarification of the enemy situation is an obvious necessity, but waiting for information in a tense situation is seldom the sign of strong leadership, more often of weakness, declared the command manual of the Wehrmacht, the German military, published in 1935 and enforced throughout World War II. The first criterion in war remains decisive action. The Wehrmacht also drew a sharp line between deliberation and implementation. Once a decision has been made, the mindset changes. Forget uncertainty and complexity. Act. If one wishes to attack, then one must do so with resoluteness. Half measures are out of place, Moltke wrote. Officers must conduct themselves with calm and assurance to earn the trust of the soldier. There is no place for doubt. Only strength and confidence carry the units with them and produce success. The wise officer knows the battlefield is shrouded in a fog of uncertainty, but at least one thing must be certain, one's own decision. One must adhere to it and not allow oneself to be dissuaded by the enemy's actions until this has become unavoidably necessary. So a leader must possess unwavering determination to overcome obstacles and accomplish his goals, while remaining open to the possibility that he may have to throw out the plan and try something else. That's a lot to ask of anyone, but the German military saw it as the essence of the leader's role. Once a course of action has been initiated, it must not be abandoned without overriding reason, the Wehrmacht manual stated. In the changing situations of combat, however, inflexibly clinging to a course of action can lead to failure. The art of leadership consists of the timely recognition of circumstances and of the moment when a new decision is required. What ties all of this together, from nothing is certain to unwavering determination, is the command principle of Auftragstaktik. Usually translated today as mission command, the basic idea is simple. War cannot be conducted from the green table, Moltke wrote, using an expression that referred to top commanders at headquarters. Frequent and rapid decisions can be shaped only on the spot according to estimates of local conditions. Decision-making power must be pushed down the hierarchy so that those on the ground, the first to encounter surprises on the evolving battlefield, can respond quickly. Of course, those on the ground don't see the bigger picture. If they made strategic decisions, the army would lose coherence and become a collection of tiny units, each seeking its own ends. Auftragstaktik blended strategic coherence and decentralized decision-making with a simple principle. Commanders were to tell subordinates what their goal is, but not how to achieve it. Imagine a top-down, command-and-control military unit approaching a town. A captain is ordered to take the town. How? Approach from the southwest, skirt the factory on the outskirts, seize the canal bridge, then occupy the town hall. Why? Not his business. The captain's job is to salute and do as he is told. What if the situation in the town turns out to be different from what headquarters expects? That won't happen. But what if it does? There is no answer. The captain will be unsure of what to do other than asking headquarters for new orders. Worse, he and his men will be rattled. As Moltke observed, it shakes the trust of subordinates and gives the units a feeling of uncertainty if things happen entirely differently from what orders from higher headquarters had presumed. In the Wehrmacht, by contrast, a captain would be told to take the town. How? That's up to him. Why? Because his superior has been ordered to prevent enemy reinforcements from reaching the region on the other side of the town. And taking the town will sever a key road. Thanks to Auftragstaktik, the captain can devise a plan for capturing the town that takes into account the circumstances he encounters, not those headquarters expects him to encounter. And he can improvise. If he comes across a bridge on another road that HQ thought had been destroyed but wasn't, he will realize it could be used to move enemy reinforcements. So he should destroy it. No need to ask HQ. Act now. Orders in the Wehrmacht were often short and simple, even when history hung in the balance. Gentlemen, I demand that your divisions completely cross the German borders, completely cross the Belgian borders, and completely cross the River Meuse, a senior officer told the commanders who had launched the Great Assault into Belgium and France on May 10, 1940. I don't care how you do it, that's completely up to you. And Auftragstaktik wasn't limited to senior officers.